That's the New York Ska Jazz Ensemble with In Motion. It's from their 2011 album, Double Edge. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we are returning to our conversation, which will dominate our discussions for the week, and that is the Clinton Foundation and matters related to it. House and Senate Republicans convinced that the Obama administration is blocking their efforts to probe and expose serious ethical and criminal violations allegedly committed by Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State have intensified their campaign. The Bill Hillary and Chelsea Clinton Foundation and several of its affiliated organizations once again are at the center of the legislators' focus as they look into how the Clintons funneled money through these entities and to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars, but described as charitable donations. But these charitable donations appear to be linked, they say, to political favors for the donors. And we also will be taking a look in this program at new and very, very troubling evidence showing the Clintons' stranglehold on Haiti, their foundation's prized possession. And I use that word literally. I've always maintained, and you know we've covered this aspect on Lead Stories several times, if you really want to get to the bottom of the greed and the craziness that was allowed to go on while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, you look to Haiti. Haiti is where you go. And today we have new revelations about Haiti and why the Clintons consider Haiti a most prized possession. Well, our guide in all of this has been Charles Ortel, who since May has been filing regular investigative reports on Lead Stories about the Clintons and their various global so-called charities. A former Wall Street banker and investor, his digging into the financials of General Electric in 2007-2008 proved that the conglomerate had fraudulently overvalued its stock by hundreds of billions of dollars. And we are very, very fortunate to have him with us as he continues to dig more and more into the Clinton Foundation, unearthing things that should cause people to worry. Well, before we get into this discussion, let's listen to a short clip. And it is interesting and instructive because it kind of captures the spirit among the Republicans right now. Here's Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky explaining on Fox News why he thinks the Clintons, and Hillary in particular, should be indicted.
The term is above the law. Is she above the law? I think often the Clintons appear to be. For example, Bill Clinton made millions of dollars giving speeches that had business before the Secretary of State. So one business wanted to sell electronics to Iran in violation of the sanctions. Bill Clinton got $750,000 from them. At the same time, Hillary Clinton was deciding whether or not she would let them sell things to Iran. Same way with the uranium company. Bill Clinton got, I think, $750,000 from a bank that was negotiating the purchase of a North American uranium company. Just so happens Hillary Clinton had to vote on that also. So the conflict of interest just goes on, and I think it's indictable. I think she should be in prison for it. But short of that, I think every vote in the country needs to know that the Clintons are in it for themselves. They're in it to make money, and they will make hundreds of millions of dollars if she gets in the White House because they will sell themselves to the highest bidder. Every voter in America should know that, and they should make a sincere judgment on whether or not you want somebody who's in it for enriching themselves or someone who actually would defend the country.
No doubt.
Senator, well, you know, say what you want. The fact is that this particular senator, Rand Paul of Kentucky, is not kidding about the seriousness and the severity of what they have discovered so far. We talked about the fact that another member of Congress, Marsha Blackburn, in fact, to this day, exactly a month to this day, had asked for a probe of the Clinton Foundation, saying that she believes there's ample evidence there of public corruption. And it has to do with the fact that the Clinton Foundation and its intricate labyrinth of related charities, they're calling these charities or initiatives or whatever it is they're calling them, they're nonetheless operating under the law as charities, as legally founded charities. However, it is increasingly clear that these organizations and foundations and related entities have an interesting way of operating that indicates that while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, a lot of political work was done, a lot of, you could call it representation, even of foreign governments. And a lot of money came in, ostensibly as donations to the foundation and to its related entities. But as Charles Vartel has been telling us, and we have been discovering along the way, many of these entities themselves are illegal, and the Clinton Foundation itself is operating illegally based on the purpose, the stated purpose of its charter, which was to build a presidential library. And soon enough, we saw the burgeoning of this effort into all these different directions, doing all kinds of things for which they're not legally mandated to do or permitted to do, including involving overseas governments and international corporations and so forth. And all of this is going on while Hillary Clinton is Secretary of State. Of course, you know her husband, Bill Clinton, was a former president. Now she is a presidential candidate. And we have more to tell you today. So let's get moving, Charles. Thanks for joining us again today. And give us an idea of where we should start.
Well, thanks again for having me on you, Teresa. Well, why don't we start with the great work that Senator Chuck Grassley is doing. I believe he's chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And last year, when reports surfaced that Uma Abedin appeared to have held down four jobs simultaneously, you know, people listening to this broadcast, we have a hard time finding one good job. Here's a very fortunate Uma Abedin who's somehow employed by our government as a special government employee, and the rules about that are strict. She gets employed as a special government employee. She gets a job working for Hillary and the Clinton family personally. She gets a job working for this suspect, in quotes, consulting firm. We're not really sure what they really do, called Teneo. And she's the fourth employer is the Clinton Foundation itself. Now, how did she pull that off? And who actually approved that? You know, what government official, unconflicted government official, approved that strange relationship? I would have thought it should have been somebody at least as high up as Valerie Jarrett, if not the president himself. I mean, how can Hillary Clinton approve such a convoluted relationship? And why did it need to be structured in that way? And how many other people were special government employees? And what does that really mean? I gather that Cheryl Mills may also have been a special government employee. And so Chuck Grassley and his staff started looking into this last year, and of course the typical Clinton approach is, you know, stonewall, delay, claim it's already been investigated. And that worked for a while, for a number of months, and then now we are getting more emails. And then suddenly Chuck Grassley sent and his staff sent a very tough letter, which is public, and I believe I shared it with you this morning, Yatrice. Maybe it'll get up on a website somewhere, but it's 10 pages of analysis and some very tough questions for Loretta Lynch, demanding specific answers by August 29th. And I think the American public does deserve to know answers to these questions. I mean, what Grassley's focusing on is, in relevant part, why was the Clinton Foundation reorganized in the way that it has been reorganized, and why did the FBI and Department of Justice elect not to prosecute what appear to be obvious infractions of multiple state, federal, and foreign laws? How did that decision-making process work? What political appointees may have been involved with this? And to see what he's talking about, you have to sift through a lot of confusion. Now, one area of confusion is this so-called memorandum of understanding that is referred to by people who don't understand what a memorandum of understanding is. If the Obama administration had been serious about trying to regulate the Clinton Foundation while it was still operating, when Hillary was Secretary of State, they would not have signed a memorandum of understanding. A memorandum of understanding, lawyers will explain and confirm, is a document that is not legally enforceable in the first place. So why would you enter into such a document, you know, if you really wanted to make sure that serious penalties applied? For one thing, in this case, there's no consideration involved. It's not a real binding contract. For a second, it's struck between the Clinton Foundation and the transition entity, which I think was a 501c4, that I guess went out of existence once the president swore the oath of office in January of 2009. Why did that agreement not bind Bill and Hillary and Chelsea and others personally? Bill was not at that point a trustee of the Clinton Foundation. In fact, he only became a trustee in 2013 after Hillary left. So why structure the agreement in this way? It was the one that was tendered into the public domain back in last year, was a version that appears to me to be a forgery. The real version is Judicial Watch provided it. It's signed by Valerie Jarrett on November 16th, 2008, less than 10 days following the, or around 10 days following the election, the historic election in 2008. Now, Valerie Jarrett was a busy bee at that point. She'd only been put on the transition team a number of days after her birthday, which I think was right before then. And it happens that in Foundation land, the 16th or the whatever the right day was, because I think that fell on a weekend, was the final day that you're allowed to fill in your tax returns. So anyone connected with the Clinton Foundation had to have known the dire state that the Clinton Foundation was in on that day, because the history now shows you, the benefit of hindsight, they didn't even get an audit done for the Clinton Foundation. It wasn't a real audit until December 12, 2008. So they were way past the filing deadline. The numbers that are hidden on the Clinton Foundation website, but you can see on the New York State Charity Bureau search version of these filings, you can see that the Clinton Foundation itself was hemorrhaging cash. Massive, it's not really fair to call them losses, but the revenues were far smaller than their expenses. And the core of the Clinton Foundation, something they've tried to hide and they claim didn't exist in a later filing, the core, the HIV-AIDS thing, had its license to operate revoked on the 31st of March 2008 in the key state of Massachusetts, where it was headquartered. So this thing was a mess. Who drafted the MOU, which describes it in glowing terms? It's almost like an application for a Nobel Prize. I mean, it talks about great work on HIV-AIDS. Rubbish. The entity that was supposedly doing that work had its license to operate involuntarily revoked. It's a very severe action in a Democrat state, Massachusetts. So how could you possibly say to the incoming presidential team, you know, that this thing was in great shape? Nothing about it was in great shape. Who made those representations? Why didn't Valerie Jarrett find out about this? Why did she accept this? You know, why did they allow this thing to go forward? And why then did the Clintons, Hillary Clinton herself, lie to her senators in her confirmation hearing? There's transmission back and forth between the Clinton Foundation and the files you can get in New York State. Look up the 2007 annual report. There's correspondence back and forth wherein an agent of the Clinton Foundation lies and says, you know, we're not sending you our audit because it isn't finished yet. That's in mid-December 2008. In mid-January, they send the audit, and it's dated December 12, 2008, one day before the correspondent with the Senate. So the sitting senator from New York, the junior senator from New York, the subcommittee or whatever that would consider her confirmation, lied to it and secured the nomination of Secretary of State on false premises. Now, you know, I don't know about the audience here. I'm a kind of a fairly calm individual, and I have no interest in politics. But if I were had been the incoming president of the United States, you know, the first African-American president of the United States, with a Congress I could, that I controlled and a Senate I controlled because my party was in control of both houses, and I discovered that my rival, my bitter rival in the 2008 campaign, had lied to me, to my core team, about the state of the Clinton Foundation, I would be rather upset. And, you know, so I don't understand why there aren't emails flying around saying, hey, Valerie, you know, what's going on here? Or from Valerie asking questions. And then through this whole reorganization, which Chuck Grassley and Marsha Blackburn are starting to get their teeth into, you know, we have not been told the truth about why the Clinton Foundations needed to be reorganized. I believe I understand the truth. No part of the Clinton Foundation was validly organized or operated, and had any part of the Clinton Foundation been run by Eutrice Leed or Charles Ortel, we would have been seriously disciplined long ago. Instead, it would appear that, from what we can see in the public domain, for some reason, the Obama administration gave these people a pass and let them attempt to reorganize the Clinton Foundation. But their attempts were so clumsy that now, as the private email server emails start surfacing, we're going to see more and more of them, we're going to see the real timeline. We're going to understand what's missing. And, you know, perhaps from WikiLeaks, we're going to see these cables that will put the whole picture together. So Chuck Grassley, again, I'm not into politics, but I can read. And when I did a little research on Chuck Grassley and his team, he is a ferocious investigator. And, you know, one of these just the facts, ma'am, kind of guys. And he's sicked an important team on, and Loretta Lynch has got some tough questions to ask. And I think Americans, not just Republicans, I think Democrats and Republicans are owed answers here. What is going on?
Well, I think it's getting also to the point where the soon-to-be outgoing president, Barack Obama, has questions to answer himself related to the Clinton Foundation, because too much has gone on that he should have known about, and there should have been indication somewhere that orders came from him or someone designated by him to get this matter fixed. But it looks like at each step of the way, the Obama administration and perhaps even the president himself looked the other way and said, look, after all, we're all out of Chicago. I was a creature of the Clintons myself politically. They did support me when I was running for president, even though we had a little bump in the road there. But we're in this together. And it is not stretching this argument a little bit, it would not be inconceivable that after he leaves the White House, Barack Obama, that is, he may go the same way and establish a kind of, he may replicate the pattern of the Clinton Foundation himself, having been carefully tutored by the Clintons in how this is done to make a lot of money.
Well, it's not he may, he's already done it. I mean, they have set up the Barack Obama Foundation in Washington, D.C., a place that is tougher to get records from that Washington, D.C. charity operation. You have to physically send somebody down there, and as we're going to start doing. But I've looked through the filings for the Barack Obama Foundation here in New York, and I will tell you categorically, though I'm not a lawyer, that the only reason that foundation exists today is because Barack Obama's people have let it flout the rules, because its purposes, as stated in its articles of incorporation, are way too broad. An ordinary presidential archive foundation would not be allowed to get its IRS authorization. But, you know, in the magic world that we live in, where the rules only matter, you know, if you're a friend, you get away with things, and if you're an enemy, you get punished. And so he's a friend, and he gets away with it for now. But now, that said, I think, you know, all Americans, again, you know, Republican, Democrat, doesn't matter, I think we can agree that the presidential foundations are useful. I mean, in this day and age of Google and digitization of records. One might wonder why, you know, every president should get a new building built. And for those who care about global warming, you know, why does it make sense to encourage Americans to get in cars and public transportation and travel all the way out to some facility when a lot of these records might easily, more easily, be just seen on the Internet? Well, let's park all that and say, you know, being president's heady stuff, and, you know, let's say that, you know, every president should have the right to have an archive. That doesn't mean, you know, there is an actual federal law on defining what a presidential archive is. In the first instance, the records that are in an archive are the property of Eutrice Leed, Charles Ortel, and all our listeners. They are not presidential property. I mean, you know, personal property. All these records are records that every American, whatever party, whatever political persuasion, has financed, and we have a right to see them, most of them. And so there was a law created years ago that codified how these things work. And basically the way they work is, you know, the records, as Barack Obama starts getting ready to leave, the records go to a suspense place to be, you know, probably in the National Archives somewhere. And then money gets raised, and I think is in the process of being raised, to build this facility out in, I believe, Chicago.
Yes.
And once that's finished, all the records go there. And in order for the National Archives to accept the facility, back when President Clinton did his thing, he had to come up with an endowment of 20% the cost of the facility. Now poor Barack Obama has to come up with 60% because the rules have changed. So if the facility costs $500 million, as some say it might, then he has to come up with another $300 million, convey that, his team has to convey it to the archives, and then the archives team takes over the job of physically managing the library. And, you know, that's the way the law works. And the library is not, you know, a moving testimonial to whatever may suit Barack Obama's fancy after he leaves becoming president. It's meant to be a building to study his time as president. And it's supposed to stop at the end of his presidency. So instead, what Bill Clinton has tried to do, and it's just boldly illegal, is to say, no, this is a, you know, living monument to me. You know, whatever I decide is important, you know, we're going to do. And they came up with this idea. Again, it's, you know, this great wordsmithing and word splitting of, you know, saying that a foundation has a right to pursue any, quote, initiatives that it wants to pursue. That's baloney. You don't have that right. I mean, if you did have that right, there'd be no need to regulate anything, right? Because you just say, well, I'm going to get, you know, a facility together to be a presidential archive, and then after I set it up and get my valuable federal and state tax exemptions, then I'll decide to do whatever I want. I'll study, you know, wild birds and or orangutans in Borneo, you know, if that's what I want to do. Then the regulations would have no force and effect. It's on its face absurd. And yet it's the kind of legal position the Clintons love to take, stretching the envelope, realizing that, you know, they'll take the position, it'll take a while for people to challenge it, then when they challenge it, they'll put up roadblocks, and the roadblocks will, you know, defer investigations and obstruct the ability of Marsha Blackburn and Grassley and others to look at it, and then the public will go tired of it, and then all the Clinton acolytes will say it's old news, there's nothing here, that she hasn't been indicted, and, you know, maybe it'll go away. But in this case, you know, we're not talking about a crummy little land deal in rural Arkansas. We're talking about billions of dollars.
Speaking of which, I'm still waiting to see a comprehensive coverage from mainstream media about the fact that the so-called tax records that were released by Hillary Clinton on Friday aren't really, as they say, the full Monty. We have not yet seen the tax filings for all of the entities associated with the Clinton Foundation.
And we will be waiting a while. Now, actually, the rules, you know, and the surprising thing here is that we haven't yet found, you know, the case, we're both, I think, old enough to remember vividly the process during which Nixon had to step down. And that case was very noteworthy to me as a young teenager because, you know, members of his own party were among the most aggressive in calling for his resignation. And here, you know, though there is, I think, lingering dissension, and the news recently about Debbie Wasserman Schultz actually working for Clinton, admitting that she was working for Clinton while chair of the DNC, There is some dissension in the Democratic Party, as there should be. Bernie supporters disappointed and furious in some cases with the way in which the Clinton team has behaved. It is surprising to me that, you know, people who understand on the left in the Democratic Party the way charities are supposed to operate, it's surprising to me that we haven't yet had a Democrat come forward and you know, stand up and join Marsha Blackburn, join Chuck Grassley, not necessarily over the political implications, but to make the point that charities are an important part of this country. They really are. The idea that a charity can relieve the burden of government, that it can encourage community service, bringing people together, you know, without regard to their party, that's a wonderful thing. It does make America great, frankly, that we have such a vital, robust, charitable sector. And it's just amazing to me that we yet haven't had somebody, and the first person in the Democratic Party to do it will actually end up being a very famous part of history, in my view. I would have thought by now we'd have at least one, if not many, reps, senators, state reps, state senators, maybe a governor or two, attorney general or two, say, you know what? There's there, you know? These people are supposed to, with this foundation, all these different initiatives and foundations, are supposed to have filed reports in 46 states and the District of Columbia. All of these reports are false and materially misleading. Why are Democrats and Republicans at the state level letting this slide? Just, you know, and in the media, you know, what I've grown to learn here, because I'm not really in the media, I'm just a dude who is interested in charity and I've got time on my hands and I'm comfortable with math. I'm discovering that a lot of the people who write, you know, are gifted writers, gifted speakers, but they're hopeless when it comes to numbers. And because they're hopeless, they don't see the obvious. It's staring them right in the face. You show them a table, you show them a problem, and they say, well, you haven't shown me any evidence because they can't understand it. But it's there.
Speaking of which, talking about the importance of philanthropy and how in many cases it is really a good thing that we do have philanthropic organizations because they pick up much needed slack where governments either are unwilling or simply cannot perform. And so they bring, in this bridging this breach, they bring much needed help to people who desperately need it. And we've been talking about Haiti. And we talked about Haiti largely in terms of the politics of Haiti and how the Clintons essentially considered Haiti their personal possession to do with whatever they want to do. And they've gotten away with it, including in personally installing the president, personally encouraging certain administrations to come to fruition and others not at all. But most significantly, dealing with, again, the Clinton Foundation. The Clinton Foundation pops up in Haiti in ways that it doesn't pop up anyplace else, and with such an incredible and a disproportionate way. I wonder, when you looked at the figures coming out of Haiti with the kind of activity that the Clinton Foundation was engaged in, the kind of money that was funneled to the foundation through Haiti, did it boggle your mind that so much money was coming out of a country that's supposedly so poor, that's supposedly so wretched, that is supposedly so much in need?
Absolutely. You know, it's amazing. I suppose someday I'll have to go down to Haiti and spend some time there because, you know, I've spent a lot of time traveling in my life, but I have yet to visit Haiti. And you know, here's a place which, if you believe the numbers that are floating around the world on its economic performance, and those are just estimates, so nobody really knows, this is a desperately poor place. I mean, this is, and it's, you know, in the great history that is known of so far modern history of man, you know, Haiti is part of the island, is on the island that Christopher Columbus supposedly discovered in 1492. So, I mean, this is a central piece of the greater American story involving all of us connected to this great country. And, you know, here we are 500 plus years later, and I would venture to say Haiti is probably poorer today than it was in 1492. And, you know, we should be asking ourselves, of all political persuasions, how could this be possible? You know, we venerate Plymouth Rock, we venerate Jamestown, we venerate, to a lesser extent, those who know our Spanish-American history, you know, we venerate Mexico City and things like that. And yet, you know, we're quite prepared to say, you know, when it comes to the Dominican Republic, comes to Haiti, Hispaniola, let's just forget about it, you know. We have no special obligation to that place, when I think we do.
So of what strategic value, then, was and is Haiti to the Clinton Foundation?
Well, I think, you know, I've sort of, it's a tough accusation to make, but I'm fully prepared to make it. The team of people around the Clintons appear to be what I would call merchants around misery. Where there's misery, they realize that hearts and wallets will open up, the internet will make a lot of money flow possible to suspense accounts, to accounts that are not that policed. So where there's misery, billions of dollars will suddenly magically appear. And since there is no effective regulatory regime, there's no global regulation of these charities, there's no international regulator powerful enough, and perhaps by design, our state regulators certainly are not equipped, in Arkansas, for example, to regulate the international operations of a foundation as crazily opaque and as, you know, poorly organized as is the Haiti, as is the Clinton Foundation. So, you know, there's nobody can actually check any of this, and the cynics, and I would sadly count myself among them, would say that for as long as there will be humans on this planet, there is going to be misery. The notion that we'll ever eliminate all misery is not going to happen, and there's going to be natural disasters that are, you know, completely outside of man's control, whether it's volcanoes or earthquakes or floods or whatever. And, you know, so long as governments around the world do us all a disservice and talk piously about how they care about maladministration and charities, but don't tighten the rules and don't make examples of these kind of things, when, you know, a $14 billion pool of money, which is a high estimate of how much money has been sent towards the Haiti mess recently, since 2010, you know, the fraudsters of the world will say, geez, this is great. You know, we can get a piece of that. And, you know, you couple, when you look actually at the government warnings in Haiti, what they tell you is that the situation is so corrupt down there that you can't even trust an official government website. So how do you actually get money into Haiti? And it would seem as if the whole system's been gamed. It's been gamed soup to nuts. You have, while Hillary was Secretary of State in this mess, while all the money was flowing, first Bill gets to be basically viceroy of Haiti with the other former prime minister. It's a UN oversight program, and we know how tightly the UN is controlled. The State Department, for some reason that has not yet been explained to we the people, did not have an inspector general for much of Hillary's term, so there was nobody looking over anybody's shoulder. Cheryl Mills, who played a central role in this, has a domestic partner who is very much involved in Haiti. The Clinton family and the Bush family had connections to companies that were operating in Haiti. And again, there's never been any accounting here of what may have happened to all this $14 billion, because nobody can stand up and say, you know, this is what happened to it. And, you know, I think the poor people around the world and, you know, people who care about philanthropy should look at this and say, you know what, we really need the equivalent of, after the Depression, there was the PCORA Commission that looked at, you know, why we had the financial collapse. We need the equivalent of that here to understand what really happened to this money. Because I happen to know a number of people, I think, Eutrice, you know one of them, more than one of them very well, Dottie Cherry and others, who really do care about this country, love to see, you know, some sort of sanity restored to it, love to see, you know, the basic requirements of civil society put in, electricity, roads, sewer systems, hospitals, schools. You know, that's something that, you know, needs to go here. And this experiment under the Clintons is a case study in you know, letting the wrong sorts of people acquire control over the levers of power. And if you can't make Haiti work, which is a country of 10 million, Haiti doesn't have to worry yet, or perhaps ever, about snowstorms and avalanches. Has its problems with earthquakes and maybe tornadoes and things like that, maybe floods. But you know, this is a country that it should have been possible over so many decades, whether Republicans or Democrats or whatever, if foreign aid could work, it should work in Haiti, but it hasn't. And we should be asking
ourselves.
Well,
you're mentioning $14 billion, and that's just in the last 6 years.
I know.
That was supposed to be directed to the post-earthquake rebuilding of Haiti. But we also know that certain other things occurred. For example, Hillary Clinton's brother ended up with the sole mining license issued in 50 years. He has a 26-year lease on that for mining Haiti's gold. There is another arrangement coming out of Arkansas, people affiliated with the Clintons, where rice, Haiti used to grow its own rice. They now have to import it from Arkansas. So you get these kinds of things that are happening under the guise of philanthropy. A lot, $14 billion.
Right.
And every day, Haitians assemble in front of the offices of Hillary Clinton demanding to know where the billions have gone. And we still are no closer to an answer. All we know is that a lot of people have made a lot of money through the Clinton Foundation and through their personal connections with the Clintons, and yet there's such abject poverty. So Haiti has marble, it has uranium, it has incredible resources of minerals and so forth, but it remains the poorest, richest country in the Caribbean.
It's just a despicable state of affairs. Does it have fresh water?
Yes, but when the water is used in mining, and we have the problem, of course, with the UN forces there contaminating the water with an outbreak of all these different diseases, it's been a problem. Haiti has been a problem, especially after the massive earthquake that dislocated so many people. But I wanted to talk about the role of the foundation and how Haiti, this place that is automatically dismissed as, well, it's a poor country and people are trying to help and so forth. So there isn't that much scrutiny, and it's in that absence of scrutiny that we find the inexplicable thriving and profit-making going on by the Clinton Foundation and people close to the Clintons doing very, very well. And we have no indication at all that the Obama administration, while she was Secretary of State and even now as a presidential candidate, nobody's paying attention. The Clintons have had a free ride in Haiti. And Haiti is one of the biggest examples of the fraud. I think that you said that this foundation is nothing but a massive fraud.
Exactly. I mean, so what you have here is you have all the combustible ingredients of a man-made disaster. You have no controls. You have no financial controls. No trustees with a moral compass, it would seem, because if there were trustees with a moral compass, they would have stood up long ago and said and removed the Clintons from the charity and forced a reaccounting of all this. So you have none of that. You have a desperately poor country. You have incoming aid flows that they're much larger than they can actually be used. And then you have all of these multilateral organizations, the IFC, the World Bank, various UN organizations and foreign aid organizations, theoretical do-gooder organizations. Then you have the various banks who are very interested in financing projects. So, and then you have these opaque firms, these advisory firms that are peopled by Republicans, by Democrats, firms like Teneo, which is Doug Band's firm. in which Bill Clinton and Tony Blair both briefly had an economic benefit. Then you have Cheryl Mills with her firm, which is called Black Ivy, and there's another State Department former employee, Jean-Louis Warnholtz, who was involved with that one. You have these, you know, public-private partnerships. When I hear the word public-private partnership, I want to call the sheriff, because, you know, that to me is just a prescription for disaster. So if you have no controls, wash and money, you can create these schemes that sound interesting. So you mentioned Tony Rodham's gold deal. You know, actually, the way these things kind of work around the world is that there are standards. Countries develop standards. And, you know, when you have, typically, when you have a lot of a natural resource in a country, then the terms that the operator gets are typically very bad, because the country knows it has the leverage. They have the gold, you want it, they're going to hold you up and require you to pay a very large royalty. What's noteworthy about this deal, from what I can tell, is that whoever negotiated it was negotiating on behalf of Tony Rodham, certainly not on behalf of the people of Haiti. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that a rapacious conservative Republican capitalist is supposed to do, not, you know, a do-gooding Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and Cheryl Mills and all their people. I mean, how did you, in good conscience, here you have a country, you know, with its history, we can debate endlessly who's responsible for it, but, you know, we can agree that Haiti is a mess. And now we discover Haiti has gold. Okay, you know, where's the Mother Teresa? Where's the Mahatma Gandhi? Where's the, you know, Nelson Mandela, who looked at this and said, you know, it just simply isn't right in this case to, you know, to strike a long-term deal here to extract this valuable gold and do it on a basis that basically is hugely preferential to the operator. And by the way, let's select an operator who's not qualified to do the mining project in the first place because he has no mining experience. I mean, it just, was there nobody in the room, you know, with a conscience to sit there and say, you know, we really shouldn't be doing this to Haiti? Evidently not. And, you know, therein lies, you know, the tragedy here. You know, there are good people on the right, and there are good people on the left. We don't have a good versus evil narrative of, you know, Republicans are good and Democrats bad, or vice versa. There's a lot of good in this country. And why did the good people stand up and do something about this? And why are the good people of America sitting down and preparing to install Hillary Clinton and the team of bounders and crooks and criminals and, you know, fraudsters who seem to follow the Clintons everywhere, possibly to take control of the White House? Why are we sitting here, you know, pliantly and putting up with this? Why aren't we asking the kind of tough questions that needed to be asked? Why aren't Democrats asking these questions?
Well, other than the Democrats and the Republicans, other than the, you know, Congress essentially looking for answers via probes, is there an independent or third way of going about this business of making the Clinton Foundation accountable and getting the records and getting the answers that are needed? Is there something independent? Somebody could file a suit. I mean, people have asked for information through the Freedom of Information Act, and they're getting frustrated and so forth. There is a major, major interruption in the flow of information coming from the Clinton Foundation. And even seasoned members of Congress are experiencing it. Is there nothing that the philanthropic community can do as a community with a vested interest in the behavior and conduct of this seemingly renegade operation?
Well, yeah, I mean, there is, actually. And it, when you go onto the websites, as I've done, of attorneys general, which tend to be the, you know, the position in a given state that has the first responder responsibility for making sure that charities are run properly, you will see in these, you know, these websites, you can pick a state at random, pious arguments about, you know, our top duty is protecting the donating public. If you know of a charity scam, please contact us. We'll investigate it. You can trust us. Every state in America, and even Washington, D.C., have government officials that could be contacted by citizens in those states in Washington, D.C., demanding an investigation. Eventually, one of them will crack. And what happened, actually, one of the reasons I reached out to Marsha Blackburn is she was part of the process that galvanized the Federal Trade Commission, that's another entity that could do this, working in concert. In that case, they got all 50 attorney generals in the United States to crack the back of a fraudulent family charity, a tenth of the declared size of the Clinton Foundation, where they were doing just the same thing. I would argue on a lesser scale, because they were operating for a shorter period of time in a narrower geographic place. And they broke the back of that charity and disciplined the people. Ultimately, I don't think the people went to jail, but they stopped the fraud. And they got penalties paid, and they made an example. And it's called the Texas Cancer Charity case. And there, to the great credit of Democrats and Republicans, they worked together. All 50 states collaborated with the FTC and did something about it. Why can't that happen here? Why can't we prove the cynics wrong that in this country, when it comes to crimes of this nature that are an affront to humanity, that we can forget about what party we're in, work together, expose, learn what the mess is, learn from how this happened, tighten up the regulations, and use this constructively as an example to police all charities that dare to solicit money inside the United States of America and operate abroad.
To your knowledge, based on what you have been able to unearth so far, what is the scope of the kind of money that has gone through or come to the foundation in its quest to do all these wonderful things that it's not licensed or legally permitted to do?
Well, the declared size on the Clinton Foundation filings, which I believe are false and materially misleading, suggest that they've gotten $2 billion at the Clinton Foundation level. Then there's an allied charity called the American India Foundation that's got $1 billion. Then there's another one called Unitaid, depending on how you look at it, that's gotten about $5 billion. Then there's the Global Fund, which is linked through the relationships the Clintons have had with Rajat Gupta, who just got out of prison recently for insider trading, to something called the Global Fund. Now, that organization is massive. That's the central repository of monies governments have been sending in to fight HIV/AIDS and other illnesses around the world. And that thing, again, depending on how you look at it, is another $60 billion or so. Then you have ad hoc things like this Haiti, that's $14 billion. The tsunami, that's $12 billion. Katrina, who knows how much that was. To use a round number, it's about $100 billion that we know about. And it's your classic fraud that, you know, you send money into a general pool, nobody audits it, nobody checks it. It's not in the interest of the accounting firms to admit that they've missed all this because they get paid a lot of money to, in theory, produce reports about, you know, slices and slivers of the piece, not the whole picture. So you're not going to get Price Waterhouse to indict itself. You're not going to get Deloitte or KPMG, the few remaining firms. And it's, in a way, it's a little bit ironic that, you know, the last big, I mean, the big fraud everyone knows about, Enron, is a tiny sliver of the size of this thing. I think Enron was like $13 billion. Here we're talking $100 billion. And what happened in Enron is very similar to what happened here. In Enron, you had all these confusing, allied joint ventures and affiliates, a shifting menu of them year by year. Nobody was checking it. Nobody checked the conflicts. It was run, the financial shenanigans part was run by an alumni of McKinsey. Rajat Gupta was chairman of McKinsey. There were a lot of McKinsey people sprinkled throughout the Clinton Foundation, including Chelsea Clinton, who worked there briefly, and Eric Braverman, who was a McKinsey partner, and left for unknown reasons shortly after signing an extension of his contract. He then, days later, he left, and no journalist has seen fit to call Mr. Braverman up and say, exactly why did you leave? Because it sure looks to us like somebody saw a rat, smelled a rat. Was it you? Did you see what was going on here? So, you know, they're to this date, we don't really know the full extent of it. And, you know, with America now has whatever we have, $21 trillion in debt. Are we so rich as a country that we don't really care what happens to $100 billion?
And I'm going back to the fact that the Clintons' declared income for 2015 is $10 million. You're telling us that more than $100 billion came into the Clinton Foundation and its various affiliates. Is it possible that the money has gone someplace and that is yet another layer of investigation to find out? Because it's hardly likely that any entity and the main people of this entity know that they've brought in at least $100 billion, that, you know, $10 million a year, they'll declare $10 million, but they certainly might have earned more than $10 million. Is there another layer of investigation coming to find out if it's possible that far more money than the $10 million was earned and it's someplace stashed in a secret account somewhere? What's happening next on that level of investigation?
Well, you see, I think that that's a fair set of questions. I mean, you know, basically, we like to think, you know, that the modern world is civilized and that law and order does operate. But the truth is, you know, we live in an unregulated planet. There is no global regulator. So if a crook wants to set up an account on the island of Vanuatu or, you know, someplace nobody's ever heard of that you're never going to check, you can do that. And so in this case, one of the reasons I've been pushing on it so hard is that, you know, I think there is a possibility that I wouldn't want to see, you know, if Mr. Trump gets to be president, I wouldn't want to see him behaving this way. And if Hillary gets to be president, we can be certain that they're going to push the envelope far more aggressively than they pushed while she was Secretary of State. Because after all, President Obama himself couldn't regulate Hillary when she was Secretary of State. Who's going to regulate her when she's president? Nobody. And so we're going to see this explode. And, you know, Barack Obama and his people, I'd like to think that, you know, they have more of a moral compass than the Clintons. Maybe I'm wrong and naive. But, you know, I'd hate to believe that one of the reasons why Mr. Obama's come out and endorsed Hillary is because he feels that if she wins, then he can get away. He can take what the Clintons have done and, you know, to a different order of magnitude, which I would hope he's not thinking. So, you know, this is an area, and I should also mention that he has a conflict of interest here, he and Michelle, because they so graciously sent $200,000 out of their Nobel Peace Prize winnings in 2010 towards the Bush, the Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund. They sent that a little bit extra. If you look at there's actually public information on exactly when and how they did that. And then I think they sent another $15,000 or so at the end of the year. Anyway, so they already did that, and, you know, if we are correct here that this is a massive fraud and should never have been authorized in the way it was authorized, I should mention, I never really answered part of one of your earlier questions. The Clintons began operating in Haiti in 2003, and they certainly were not authorized to do what they started doing back then. They did a whole bunch of projects. No one ever really checked. There's no evidence of what really happened, for example, in 2003. You look at the entry of program service expenses, and you'll discover that there's no money paid for salaries in that number. Well, how could you run projects in Haiti without paying anybody anything? It just doesn't make any sense. By law, you have to tightly control international activities. So, you know, going all the way back, right the way back to 2003, there are gaping holes in these disclosures. By 2008, I think it's April 2009, Bill was appointed special UN envoy to Haiti. He set about then concocting projects in Haiti in the name of the Clinton Foundation without having the appropriate authorization. He mentions in his annual report under his signature, so it's kind of tough to say he didn't mean this, that he had created something called the Clinton Haiti Fund. There's no record of that. He then claims that they've organized all kinds of, you know, shipments of cars and trucks and generators and stuff like that. Again, there's no audit of that. It doesn't foot his disclosures in his annual report, contradict what he says on his 990, and further contradict what's in the annual reports, the supposed audits for 2010. So it's one massive mess. And, you know, we understand, if you want to run a charity properly, there are a lot of people around who are willing to pitch in, as we discussed, and work for free and will do good work. There shouldn't be this kind of a mess. you know, no audit on the $14 billion, no audit on the foundation in Haiti. There shouldn't be this kind of massive problem.
Well, there is, and we will get further into it tomorrow.
All right.
So thank you so much for today. We are getting more and more clear about what this Clinton Foundation has been doing and not doing, and why we should all be concerned about it. And we should be monitoring this particular issue because it's going to erupt, I think, into a major problem for Hillary Clinton in the not-too-distant future. Thanks so much, Charles Ortel. Some people can reach, have access to what you've been doing at charlesortel.com. That's where you post your findings and relevant documentation and so forth for the things that you've been discussing on the program.
And I also try to tweet out at Charles Ortel, uppercase C, uppercase O, and you know, throughout the day, typically I send a bunch of tweets out on what's going on. Please feel free to follow me there or contact me there, and thanks so much for having me on, Yatrice.
Thank you again for today. That brings us to the end of our program. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Infectious Myth with David Crowe. You can reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories, at gmail.com. Let me know what you think about this program. A pleasure always and a great privilege to be in your company. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.